Hey there, it's Jim Stengel, host of the CMO Podcast. We're all marketers here, so let's be real for a sec. We all know that your website shouldn't be a static asset. It should be a dynamic part of your strategy to build your brand and drive conversions. That's marketing 101. But 54% of marketing leaders say web updates take too long. That's over half of you listening right now. And that's where Webflow comes in. Their visual-first platform allows you to build, launch, and optimize web pages fast. That means you can set ambitious marketing goals and your site can rise to that challenge. Learn why teams like Dropbox, IDEO, and Orange Theory all trust Webflow to achieve their most ambitious goals today at webflow.com. Want to drive greater success in social commerce? With Deloitte's latest creator economy research, you can. After surveying over 500 creators and 500 brands, our insights are helping CMOs and marketing teams harness the power of content creators. And not only that, but how to do it well. See for yourself by visiting cmo.deloitte.com today.
So the first brand that you remember early in your life making an impact on you?
Mitsuno, which is a Japanese brand, and they made wonderful rugby boots. I couldn't afford them. All my buddies had them, and that brand still sticks with me today.
When was your first pair? I assume you eventually got a pair.
I did, and the rugby club bought it for me, which was awesome. So, and that was really special.
Hi, I'm Jim Stengel, and I help major brands find their purpose and activate it, and the profits follow. For 7 years, I was the global marketing officer for Procter & Gamble, where I oversaw the marketing of hundreds of brands. You may not know it, but the CMOs, the chief marketing officers of all of your favorite brands, are trying to connect you with your favorite products and services through purpose. And on this show, I delve into how they do it. My guest today on the CMO Podcast is Stuart Aiken. He's a Scot. He grew up in South Africa, and he's now the CEO of 8451, a leading data science and analytics company. Stuart's a CEO now, but he has been a CMO of two large retailers. This podcast is an unusual one, and it's anything but wonky. It's a useful look at the future of marketing through the lens of a brilliant data scientist. Plus, we had a lot of fun. We talked about being dads, we talked about being a rugby player, and we talked about his childhood in South Africa and how that impacted him as a human being and as a leader. This is my conversation with Stuart Aiken. Stuart, you're the first Scot on the CMO Podcast and the first person who has been a CMO and a CEO, and you're the first advisor to the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland that we've had on the podcast.
And a U.S. citizen, thankfully.
So. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So are you really an advisor to the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland?
I am on the Business Advisory Council here in Cincinnati. And yes, I am an advisor to the Fed, and was asked to actually join the Fed up in Cleveland, but the time commitment was just crazy. You've done your research. I'm impressed.
Well, what's that like, being with the Fed?
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's been a great learning experience, understanding, listening to how they think about the economy, what they focus on, obviously two areas of focus, regardless of what others believe the focus should be, but unemployment and how the economy is running, inflation.
Is it a geeky discussion or?
It can be, but when you look at the eclectic group of people around the table, it becomes fascinating because you have everyone from small business to educators to economists to large businesses like a Kroger and the likes. It truly gives you a good, solid foundation of what's happening in the economy.
Well, we're going to get into your career path in a little while, but the first thing I want to do is talk about your company. You're the CEO of perhaps the most mysterious company I've talked to date. It's called 8451, so it sounds very James Bondish.
Love it.
So can you bring our listeners into kind of what's going on there, why they should care about it? What kind of company is this?
Absolutely. And Jim, you know, from a branding standpoint, how do you remember those numbers?
I remember them.
I'm impressed. So we named it 8451, and it really is a nod to two specific things. One, it is the longitudinal address here in Cincinnati, where we're sitting right now. And the reason we called it 8451, the longitudinal address, is it's a nod to the fact that we look at customers over time. We look at customers longitudinally. It is also an incredibly complex thing to solve, and it took hundreds of years to actually solve the problem of longitude. It's also numbers. We're a numbers-based company. We hire mathematicians, statisticians, and the likes, and all of those culminated in 8451. The beautiful thing is, as soon as someone says, you work for who, what's that? It invokes a conversation, and you can start to talk about what it is you do, why it is you do what it is we do, which is in purpose of making customers' lives easier by leveraging the data Kroger has today to make individual customers' lives easier.
So you're about 4 years old, right, as a separate entity, and you deal with a tremendous amount of data, correct?
We do, terabytes and terabytes of it, and a multitude of types of data.
And the data comes from customer interactions?
It does. We
other sources?
It does. We capture the data from Kroger's Plus Card. And every time there's a purchase, we're able to capture that information in order to provide real value back to customers. And that value comes back to customers in a number of forms. One example might be fuel points and customers getting fuel points for purchasing at Kroger. Another example would be coupons we get. And I've got to pause here for a second. We'll send out 12 million pieces of direct mail. Yes, direct mail, snail mail in this age of digital. What's fascinating is what we'll do is track whether or not customers react differently if we send them to them digitally or via snail mail. It's amazing how many customers change their behavior based on how we communicate with them. But when they get those mailers, what's most impressive is the letters Kroger gets back, the thank yous, the appreciation, largely based on timing of when those coupons drop on someone's floor. If someone is genuinely struggling to get to the end of the month and they get a coupon for a free chicken or a discount off items they typically buy, that value to that individual household is enormous, and it's extended to the brands, the CPGs, as well as to the retailer themselves, in this case, Kroger.
So you're how many people now at 8451?
We have 1,100 people. Wow. Been growing incredibly quickly and incredibly fortunate. And we're doing a variety of things for Kroger, from helping them think about the basic four P's of marketing: pricing, promotion, product, and placement. So where we place items in the store to make it more convenient for customers to get in and get out. The past always used to be, hide the milk so that they have to go all the way through the store. No, how do you make it more convenient for customers who just want a gallon of milk to get in and get out? So how do you start thinking about these things differently? How do you think about pricing differently? How do you focus on having the right variety for customers? And that's essentially how we leverage the data today to provide that value back to customers.
So you use the Kroger data, which is a mountain of data, of course, but you have other customers, correct?
We have a little over 1,500 CPGs that we work with today. Exactly. Huge number of customers.
Are there any general statements you can share with our listeners about what you've learned using this data with this 1,500 CPGs in terms of principles, behaviors, interesting
yes
nuggets?
I'd love to. Here's a great nugget. It doesn't matter the data you have. What matters is the lens you place on that data. And let me just give you an example I like to use. Let's pretend for a moment you are the Kroger butter category manager. If you are that category manager and a CPG comes to you, I'll pick on one, Land O'Lakes, and they say, we've got this brand new organic butter. It's on trend. It's going to sell off the charts. And you have 10 SKUs, 10 items on your shelf. How do you determine which item to take off that shelf? If you have a profit lens, you will likely rank those 10 SKUs and pull that last item off. The problem is, if that bottom SKU, and I'm going to pick an extreme example, is kosher butter. What did I do? I didn't lose the sales and profitability of that item. I lost that customer. Mm. And I lost every customer buying that item. Here's where data becomes incredibly important. The substitutability of that item is incredibly important. And that's an algorithm we have to see whether an item is substitutable or not. What's interesting is typically items 1, 2, 3, and 4 on the bottom of that profitability list are your niche items, your items that are really important and not substitutable. Items 4, 5, and 6 are your copycats of 7, 8, 9, and 10. The problem is, if I'm going to pull item number 4, I have to trust in that data in a big, big way, that it's the right thing for the customer, it's the right thing for the retailer, and it's the right thing for the CPG. And the data helps make those decisions.
That's fabulous. That's fabulous. So I want to take the helicopter up a bit, but that was a really good discussion. And I'm looking forward to getting your views on brands and marketing and CMOs, because you, of all people, have a unique lens. You have 2 degrees in information management. You've had 2 CMO-type roles at Safeway and Michaels, 2 amazing retailers. And by the way, I have no idea how you managed at Michaels. What do they have, like 50 million SKUs?
They do.
That
they
place
have a
gives
lot
me a
of
headache
SKUs.
Every time I walk through.
High margin, but a lot
SKU
of SKUs.
City. Yes. I mean, unbelievable. And you've been a CEO at 2 data science analytics companies. So your perspective is unbelievable. But I have one big question first. If I go to one more marketing conference and there's a session on is data killing creativity, I'm going to throw up. So when do we move beyond that? Why is that still such a tension in our industry?
I love the question. There seems to be this pendulum swing every 5 years or so where this notion of it's all creative, and then it swings to it's all science and data-based. There is no question in my mind that pendulum needs to swing to the middle and stop. There is no amount of data that can create some of the most amazing commercials we've seen. There is no amount of data that can do that. But it's the nuggets and insights that lead to that incredible perspective that I think is priceless. So how do you marry those two pieces? It's the marrying of the data and the science that gets to the heart of problems. Something P&G is famous for, and I'm going to pick on an example, one of the best examples I can think of. And I have no doubt in my mind you will know the example I'll share. And it's the Like a Girl commercial.
For Always.
For Always, exactly. 2015 commercial. Unbelievably powerful, right? That the nugget was a young girl doesn't run like a woman acts when she's asked what a girl runs like, or a boy or a man is asked what a girl runs like. Why? That's the nugget. That's the insight. And then the portrayal of that was the creativity, which was just priceless, where they just filmed people, didn't ask them to act. It was all natural. And you saw that. That's powerful. And for me, that's a great example of marrying those two pieces like nothing I've seen before.
Yeah, it's been a great thing. And they've stayed with it. And it's continued to
be successful.
Grow the brand and be successful. Absolutely. So I now want to go back a little bit to your upbringing and go way back in the life of Stuart. And you're a Scot, born in...
I was actually born in Cape Town, South Africa.
You were born in, okay.
Both my parents are Scottish.
Scottish, but you were born in South Africa and you were raised largely in South Africa.
For 10 years in South Africa and then moved to Scotland.
And you were raised at least part of your upbringing with a single mom?
Most of it.
Single mom.
Exactly.
You were a big sports person.
Yes.
Rugby and swimming.
Yes.
And you eventually went to university at Scotland and studied information management and got 2 degrees.
Correct.
and I think went on to be a professor, which we'll talk about later. So what about that upbringing, which versus your peers here in the U.S., probably a little bit unusual. What about that has defined you as a leader, as a human being, as a CEO, as a parent? You know, what about that upbringing was pivotal?
Great question. Obviously, growing up in South Africa during apartheid, it had a massive, massive impact on me. But as a young child, you know there's something happening here, and being open to seeing what's actually happening around you, regardless of what the news or whatever, which was clearly being propagandized, that had, and still today, has a huge impact on me. But going to Scotland, I thought I was leaving this notion of bigotry. And the first question I was asked when I went to the UK was, which football team, soccer team did I support? And it was, are you a Rangers or Celtic supporter? And I wasn't being asked what football team I support. I was being asked what religion I was. And that same bigotry that existed in South Africa existed in the UK, but on a completely different basis. And this notion of bias, the Like a Girl example, I actually chair the network of executive women, Women's Edge at Kroger, single mom. Others who've been oppressed for way too long, women in the workforce. That has had a massive impact on me. And being able to look at someone and say, regardless of your race, your background, your creed, it doesn't matter. Why am I any better, worse than you are? We're not. We're human. We're people. And as a CEO, seeing everybody in the organization as no different than me helps me. In the office, I don't have an office. I sit in a cube the same size as everybody else. I love that. I get to know my team. I get to know my people. We've got an amazing HR leader, Beth Giglio, and she has helped us move massively forward in who we recruit, how we recruit. We were going to universities that were white-dominated males. What are we doing? You know, if you look at STEM programs, only 30% of STEM programs have women in them. How do we bring more women into that space? 43% of our team now is women, and honestly, they work a damn sight harder than some of us white dudes. So
43% of your data science company is women.
Yes, fabulous. Absolutely. And
fabulous.
Constant focus on pay equity. It's a massively important thing to me and my leadership team and Kroger. There's a talent pool out there that people are leaving behind. It's a huge opportunity for all of us. So how has my background affected me? It's affected me in looking at everybody, every opportunity to help our company be a better company, not based off of who's the easiest to hire, but who's the right person to hire, regardless of their background.
Stuart, I want to get now a little bit more into your career. And it's been heavy in retail and technology, right? And you were a professor for a while, but you seem to have abandoned the classroom and gone into industry and into retail and into analytics. So what was in your mind? Why did you make that move? Why did you jump? You were in academics.
Yeah.
From what I know about you, you probably enjoyed that.
Loved it.
So what compelled you to shift?
Great question. I taught artificial intelligence back in the early 90s when it was
nascent.
Very. Landed up getting into IT. I was a programmer in Silicon Valley. I thought I was going to be a bazillionaire, failed miserably, but a great learning experience. What got me to shift was people taking bets on me. people seeing something, quite frankly, I didn't see in me. These are prominent people today in the retail world. Brian Cornell,
CEO of Target, yeah,
still a phenomenal mentor of mine, and took a bet on me to move to Michael's with him from Safeway, and he took a bet. The current CMO or the VP of marketing at the time, Mike Manassi, took a bet on me to move from IT to marketing. And I think about that an awful lot. These were big, big bets individuals were paying and put in me. How can I pay that back? How do I look at an individual and say, there is something there that I need to pull out of someone else, and how do I pay that back? I'll be forever in debt with these people who took big bets on me. It wasn't me. I didn't plan anything out. These were truly bets taken on me.
We've all been there. You spend millions of dollars each year driving traffic to your company's website, and then the results come in and they're just not what you hoped. On top of that, 81% of marketing leaders say website ownership is a challenge. So what do? Well, you switch to Webflow. Let me tell you why. Webflow's visual-first platform empowers your team to own your company's most valuable dynamic marketing asset, your website. From launching a new site to optimizing for SEO and conversions, Webflow gives you the tools you need to drive business growth fast. Unlock your website's full potential when you build, manage, and host with Webflow. Get started today at webflow.com.
When you were back in school, did you think you would have a career in academics?
Absolutely. Listen, one day I'd love to go back and teach that. I wanted to be a PE teacher. I wanted to, I love working with kids. In fact, my son's just started university, and what's he going to be? A teacher. Good for him.
Fantastic.
Yes, I will go back and teach one day. I can't wait.
So academics to Safeway, to Michaels, to Dunnhumby, another data science firm, and then to 8451, which is affiliated with Kroger. So what about that career? Where was it the toughest in that career track so far? What job, what assignment, what time was really trying for you?
Man, I'd love to ask you that same question.
I have a good answer for that. We can go there if you want.
Good. We yeah. should, because... I'd love to know if it's similar to mine, which is honestly the higher up you get in an organization, the more, quite frankly, out of touch you are with what getting your hands dirty and actually having a real impact. The impact you have today, or I have today, is picking the right people for the right job, coaching, mentoring, pushing, lifting up. And you see them grow, and that's the gratification you get. The instant gratification I had when I was a coder, there will never be anything like that again. I'd work until 3 a.m, be back in the office at 7, nothing like it. But today, the hardest part is genuinely not having my hands around the data. Knowing I have to do everything through others is, I miss the work.
Yeah. The short answer to that question for me is when I was at P&G, actually I wasn't terribly senior, but I was sent to an acquisition and the acquisition was not happy about being acquired. And there was just a fundamental lack of trust. And to be in an environment where there is no trust is the toughest.
So, how did you build it?
Through behavior, through action, through consistency, through openness, through seeking for win-wins, for not being the arrogant acquirer, to be a translator, and to try to preserve what was special about that business and brand while becoming part of P&G.
Right.
So,
because at the end of the day, that was the acquiring company.
That's right.
But building that trust. And trust is such an important word, especially in something like that.
It's essential. in everything. But that was hard. That was hard on my business life, personal life, because it was just it was all in.
Did you move your family too?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's the top part too.
So it's but anyway, I want to get back to you. You've now been a CEO for 10 years.
Yes.
So I want you to talk about that 10-year span. How are you a better CEO now than you were 10 years ago? What has changed in how you lead?
Learning to let go. Realizing I can't do it all myself. Realizing that I need to hire people better than me, much better than me. And trust me, every single person that works for me is smarter than me.
Good for you.
I'm incredibly, incredibly lucky from that standpoint. But I think that's the biggest transition I went through was realizing I don't do the work. The folks reporting to me get the work done. So how do I get the best people out there and put them in a culture they love to work in, an environment that's fun, that's vibrant, that's exciting, that they want to be in? You know, there are always going to be people who will pay them more than what we will pay them. But can we provide an environment where they truly love to come? They get up in the morning and they want to come to the office. That makes such a difference.
Everyone tries to, or it says they try to create that kind of culture. What tips do you have, or what have you done to build that at 8451?
No offices. Doesn't matter what level you are in the business, we are all in this together. So that's first and foremost. Secondly, having an open door policy. People need to feel like they can come to me or anyone in the leadership team with any issues. And shame on me if I react badly. And if it's directed at me too. That's first and foremost. It's going back to your point around trust when you had to go help bring the other company in. Building that trust and being a genuine leader, it's okay to show emotion. It's okay to say, I messed up. And in fact, I find the value of that is so much greater than any harm that could come from that, or people thinking you're weak or whatever some other book might tell you. Being open, genuine, real with people versus putting on airs. I love that and want that from the rest of my team. And I'll have folks from around the organization come tell me when others aren't necessarily exhibiting that same behavior, which is powerful.
So self-correcting.
As well. Yeah.
So you're pioneering in data science and analytics, right? You're one of the leading companies in this space. So you need to be making mistakes, stretching, frying Absolutely. Things, breaking things. How do you handle that? How do you build the culture to do that? And how do you make it okay for people to productively experiment and fail?
You know, it's a great question because expectations today of failure is not great, especially in retail. Retail is tough. You know, razor-thin margins, one mistake can be catastrophic. So how do you test and learn? How do you create small environments where you can go test, learn, see if something works? If it doesn't, hey, not you failed, but rather good job. What did you learn? Let's take the learnings and move to the next thing. If you are open to that culture of what did you learn? How can you take that and apply it to the next thing you do? We want you all day long in the business. There cannot be enough testing and learning going on in the business. And I'm open to people testing and learning without telling me. Go. The more we do of that, the better.
You mentioned earlier Brian Cornell as a mentor. Are there others who have been important in your career or your development? Is there anyone else you'd like to highlight? And more importantly, what did they do to help you move forward?
Yeah. I've had a number throughout my career. There was someone who hired me into Safeway, into their technology area, their advanced technology group. And he took a big bet on me. And his name was Bob Dunst, retired now, but a phenomenal individual who took a bet on me. Mike Manassi, who ran marketing for Safeway, took a bet on me. Brian Cornell took a bet on me. Quite frankly, Rodney McMullen took a big bet on me.
Mm-hmm.
both joining Dunnhumby, he was on the board of Dunnhumby USA, has been on the board, and then took a massive bet on the team when he acquired us in 2015. A massive bet. He put me on his leadership team. Again, a massive bet, taking a bet that 8451 can help Kroger move into the 21st century at speed, at pace, being willing to take risks, take the culture and infuse data science, better decision-making into the Kroger business itself. Rodney's been a phenomenal player for that for me.
Now let's turn our lens a bit to brands and marketing. I know we're already talking about it, but I want to open up the aperture. If CMOs of the world had your lens on what you see happening in data science and analytics and creativity, what would they be doing differently in your mind? How would they spend their time differently? How would their jobs be different? How would they, you know, how would they recruit? How would they work with their partners? So talk to me a bit about that.
Let me ask you a quick question, because you'll probably have it off the top of your head. What's the average tenure for a CMO
today? About 4.5 years.
4.5 years. That's on the forefront of a CMO's mind. And that's a problem. And how do you move away from that? Because that fear of being moved on is too prevalent, which means CMOs are less likely to take risks, take that step forward, do something different that the brand maybe hasn't done before. Go do research that actually reveals a nugget that is truly priceless. And then how do you creatively bring that to life in ways that hasn't been done before? We're about to do that with a 136-year-old brand at Kroger, and we're taking a bet, and we believe that this bet could be huge for Kroger, but it's a bet. But it's based on data science, but from a creative standpoint, is a massive shift from where Kroger's been before. If you think about it today, the Kroger brand plays in a space that is a sea of sameness. We have to break through that sea of sameness that is retail today and truly talk to customers in ways that are new and unique. For me, that's what CMOs need to be doing, thinking about the brand itself, embracing the brand, understanding that brand, and then talking about it in ways that are new and unique and relevant for today's society, not a society even 20 years ago.
I can't wait to see what's coming.
A little teaser for you.
And we're talking about a $120 billion company
That's right.
doing that.
That's
this
right.
is not a small
feat.
Yeah.
So, it's exciting and looking forward to it.
What would you say is the key to success for today's CMO? If you said data, you wouldn't be the only one. At Deloitte, however, we believe data is only half of the equation. The other half, story. Because data is the language of business, but story is the language of humans. And we believe the most successful CMOs know how to harness the power of both data and story. To learn more about Deloitte's CMO program and how we can help today's CMOs succeed, visit cmo.deloitte.com.
So you have a window into hundreds and hundreds of CPG companies and obviously Kroger, and you're in touch with what's going on in the industry. How should marketing and brand building change as we look forward?
So as I look at the CPG, so if I take a little further step back from what you just did there, Jim, CPGs today are looking at all of these small brands popping up. It doesn't matter what category you're in.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. I'll pick on beer for a moment. Mm-hmm. But the craft beer industry is insane. The number of new microbreweries that are popping up all over the place. And what the large CPGs are doing are trying to buy them up left and right versus going, what is it that these brands are doing that we're not? And versus trying to emulate that, create that, have incubation within their businesses, they're trying to buy that incubation versus creating it inherently based off of what consumers want. The biggest issue, quite frankly, is how quickly consumers are changing today. You know, 30, 40 years ago, that cycle of change was there, but nowhere near the frequency it's happening today. So for the CMO today, understanding that frequency of change and being able to adapt and, in fact, in some cases, lead and create the change that you can see coming. And it's there in the data. It doesn't matter what field you're in. You know, Google shares their data all the time on search terms. Well, whatever industry you're in, that's a basic way to understand what new trends and how do you marry that up with purchase behavior data to better understand what's coming and how do I get ahead of it.
So what's your feeling? I know this is kind of maybe an unfair question, but which categories or which brands or which companies do you feel are taking advantage of these capabilities? I mean, obviously you're working with Kroger. So if you look beyond that, which segments? Is it financial services? Is it automotive? Which ones do you think are leading the way or more progressive?
What's going to happen in financial services in the next 10 years is going to be mind-blowing. When you start thinking about blockchain, the fact that even my mother talks about Venmo today, how quickly the financial services industry is going to change, who's going to get in there, who's going to be the next Uber of financial services is just going to be mind-blowing. I can't wait. The other big industry, I'd tell you that, especially in the US, that I see big change coming in, is healthcare and the number of startups in healthcare. Look, it's a $3.5 trillion business. Yes, we're 120 some billion dollar business in the grocery retail space, which is a $1.5 trillion business when you include restaurants. Healthcare is a $3.5 trillion business that's not been disrupted, that needs disruption. And you can see all these startups coming. And the big issue I see in healthcare in America is 70% of the dollars are spent on the managing the issue once it's become a major issue versus preventative medicine. Most westernized countries focus on that preventative side. Where I see big change coming is on that preventative side in the US incredibly quickly. Startups left and right in that space. Such a huge market space. And by the way, it's going to be phenomenal for people. And think about grocery. You know, the three biggest disease states in America are caused by food. Right. Hypertension, heart health,
diabetes.
And diabetes. Exactly right. All food related. How can we help consumers make better choices? For example, sodium. I've analyzed my data 17 ways to Sunday, as you might imagine.
Of course you have.
And I've got high sodium in my diet. I'm not going to, and the number one item I'll share, bacon. I'm not going to stop eating bacon. But if I buy low sodium bacon, low sodium butter, low sodium salt, low sodium, I can have a dramatic impact on my purchase behavior, on my sodium intake, just by doing lots of little changes. How do we bring that to customers and help them at scale? That's what you're going to see. Major change in healthcare coming.
It's exciting. So what's the next generation? I blockchain, machine learning, AI, got it. But if you think about data science and analytics going forward, what are you excited about, kind of the next threshold?
Wonderful, wonderful question. I'll push on that a little. Harvard recently did a study, and they took high school students, math students, good ones, and Harvard math students, and then gave them two different data sets, one clean, great data set, and the other crappy data. Which one could provide the best algorithm for predictive whatever? It doesn't matter. The best data won every time. Data matters. So how do you have the best data? Because that algorithm, that AI that you're using only works on the best data set. Now, how do you take data? And forgive me right now, but if you have evil in your mission statement, that's a problem. But how do you take data, protect it for your consumer, and then provide real value back? And at Kroger, we provide real value back for the data that we get. We see that genuinely as a privilege, not a right. And that privilege needs to be returned by giving value back to customers, giving them those offers, those coupons, those fuel points, et cetera, giving them great prices on items that matter most. At the end of the month, the terrible twos, when people are struggling to get to, how do we put smaller items in the ad, those sorts of things. For me, the future of AI, the future of these algorithms is based on having the best data set and then having the right lens on that data with the right intent. That's the future.
How do we ensure we have that good data going forward?
It's clean all in data. The collection. It's good data and then data that customers are very open to you having because they see value in it and being transparent on that. And in the UK or in Europe, GDPR has forced that on companies. And at Kroger, we're looking to get ahead of that, you know, CCPA in California right now, new legislation that's coming. And in fact, Nevada just passed theirs that will take place in October. But all this legislation is coming because of some of the negativity and bad things that have happened in the past. How do you get ahead of that? How do you deliver real value to customers with real transparency? And that's what Kroger's trying to do.
I'm going to have to end this beautiful interview with a series of kind of lighthearted questions, but they're also meant to get at some insights from your background and your perspective in the world. So call it a slow lightning round.
Okay.
So the first one is, you're a quant kind of guy, right? So what's the geekiest thing you do?
The geekiest thing I do. So I love to ride my road bike and I analyze the data on my road bike 17 ways to Sunday. Again, I use an app called Strava and I will, use that to better my time every time. The amount of data I have on cycling is just
Do you insane. Share that or it's just for yourself?
Just for myself.
That's
very geeky. That's my geeky. Thanks.
So how many bones have you broken playing rugby?
Great question. I broke my neck. I've had a disc removed from my back. My hands are an absolute disaster. Too many to count. 9 knee surgeries. It's a rough sport. But I'd never change a thing.
Do you still play?
I have wish. My knees gave out, which is why I swim, which is why I ride my bike now. But I was paid to play through university and just a phenomenal, phenomenal sport. Came second in the country in the US 2 years running. I played on an all Tongan team in San Francisco and we came second in the country 2 years running.
Wow.
My nickname on the team was White Chocolate. I took that as a great compliment.
So tell us more about the nickname.
It was an all Tongan team. And
okay.
All right. I was
got it.
The one gringo.
So your favorite ritual at 8451, is there something you do every day or week or at the end of the week or end of the month or around holidays? Any ritual that you cherish there?
I don't know if it's a ritual, but I love getting in the office early. So I'm in
That's
the office before 6 o'clock. And that first hour and a half, 2 hours is priceless. That's my ritual.
Anyone else there?
Sometimes. A few others.
When's the earliest you've ever gotten into your office?
Board meetings and the like. So I'll get in 2-3 in the morning, make sure I'm prepped and ready. I can get up early. I'm lucky. Knock on wood.
Or stay up late.
Exactly.
So tell us what you listen to or watch or read every day. Anything?
You know, I read an incredible amount of trade press every day because retail is changing so quickly, rapidly, evolving. the retail models evolving. And then, quite frankly, Amazon created that. They've reinvented what it means to make money and how you make money in retail. But reading what they're doing, what every other retailer, whether it's apparel, electronics, retail, grocery, you name it, I'm a passionate reader of any trade magazine.
Super. How about books? Do you read books? Anything interesting lately?
I wish I had time to read books, but the one I just read was the John Doerr book on OKRs. And in fact, I was listening to it versus reading it because I do that on my long bike rides. And I was shocked with some of the folks who read for John Doerr. You know, Bono read for him, Bill Gates read for him. It was just an unbelievable listen.
But fun, huh?
But fun. Oh, my goodness.
Do you watch series? Yours, of course, Netflix? As well. What's that?
Yours, of course, as well.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
In fact, I have a signed book from you, and I bet you didn't know that.
I think I did, actually.
Did you?
Okay. I have a good memory.
Cheers. I appreciate that.
So do you watch series, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu? Not really.
Don't watch that many shows, I'm afraid.
How about the movies? Do you go to the cinema? Not really.
No. You know, and you it drives 8451 insane. Here's why. They are all unbelievable fans of Star Wars.
Of course they are.
One of the guys there, Piyush and Milan, love it. They bought me the trilogy. I still have left it in the cellophane. I'm almost to the point where I'm doing it just to spite them.
You know what you could do for them? Do you have any like Star Wars Lego models around the office?
Oh, huge fans of that as well.
They're everywhere around the office. I was going to say you could get them some Lego models and build them for them. They would like that. Yeah,
exactly.
So what's your favorite thing to do when you return to Scotland?
See my family. I know I'll never go back to Scotland. I truly believe the American dream. I told you about South Africa. I told you about Scotland. I firmly believe that this land of opportunity is absolutely here. It's alive. It's thriving. People just need to see it. And I see it every day. I feel it every day. I believe I'm living it every day. So I go back. I love seeing my family. I hate the weather. But isn't that what every person from the UK complains about, the weather? But for me, living in America is something incredibly special. Becoming a citizen is incredibly special. Something I owe to my wife, who introduces me, by the way, as her mail order husband.
you can't just drop that in there. Does she do that?
She and I met in a summer camp in northern Wisconsin, of all places. When I first started university, I wanted to visit every continent, and I started with North America, fell in love with this summer camp. Fell in love with the people there and met my wife there.
How many years ago?
22 years ago we got married, and 25 years ago we met.
Oh, that's a sweet story.
Yeah.
So you go back there, I hope?
We do. We have friends that still live up there in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, of all places.
So it is beautiful about 2 months a year.
That's right. The 2 months we were at summer camp.
It's very romantic, those 2 months.
Exactly, exactly.
I've been up there. It is beautiful.
So it is lovely. But I was just back there, played a little golf, saw my mom, and it was great.
So one last personal question, then we'll end it. You're a father. How have you managed to be a great dad with this crazy career you have?
You know, badly. In my mind, I think I'm good. I might turn this on you too, by the way. In my mind, I think I balance it well. In my heart, I know I could do a lot better. I wish I did do a lot better. I take my work home sometimes, and that's really tough. And I wish I was better at that. It is a balance. It is hard, but I can be better. I know. I'd ask you the same thing, especially with all your travel and moving your family.
Yeah, we moved a lot. But I would have to say the proof, I think, is in the pudding. You know, my kids are older than yours. They're out of school. They're working. They're adults. And we are wonderful friends. That's and awesome. We look forward to getting together. There's no one else we'd rather spend time with. And that didn't just fall out of the air.
Do you take them on family vacation?
Of course we do.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's it.
We just make a point of being together. And we just had a family wedding, which was just really very special.
Do you ever talk about the travel you had and the amount of travel you had and the impact on
the
kids?
Sure. Yeah. So, and some of that they participated with us, you know, because we when we lived in Europe, in Eastern Europe, we didn't travel back to the States. We traveled in Europe to see everything we could when we were there. And they love those memories.
Yeah. And they talk about it like
it's a great shared experience.
Yeah. Exactly. And stuff you can talk about today, relate to today.
Yeah,
that's phenomenal. And something many kids would only dream of. So
yeah, that's right. It's a great opportunity.
Lucky for your kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So final question. Who would you like to hear on the CMO podcast?
Ooh. Well, I'd love to hear Rodney.
Rodney, the CEO of Kroger.
And Brian Cornell.
CEO of Target. So two of the most important, biggest retailers.
And two individuals who are
wonderful leaders with great stories.
Who had huge influence on my life, and it's exactly why I'd love to hear their stories.
We will see what we can do, but great idea, Stuart.
Happy to introduce you to both.
Thank you. I appreciate
generous
that.
Generous and personal, and it's been a fabulous podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
That was my conversation with Stuart Aiken. What I loved about this one was this gentleman's honesty, his sincerity, his passion for his work, his passion for his team and his people, and his genuine view that the future is bright if we use data in the right way to help people and help customers improve their life, make better decisions. That's it for this episode of the CMO Podcast. If you found this helpful and entertaining, I would be so grateful if you could share our show with your friends. And I would be super happy if you subscribed so you can be updated as we publish new episodes. And if you really want to help, leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The CMO Podcast is a Gallery Media Group original production.